You can keep up with all the episodes of the Journalism Salute by checking out our newsletter. The link is at the bottom of the show notes. Hope you'll subscribe. And let us know where you're listening from and what you think of the podcast. Email us at journalismsalute@gmail.com. Thank you. Hi and welcome to the Journalism Salute. I'm Mark Simon. In each episode, we'll talk to or about an interesting person or organization related to journalism. The intent is to show that journalists are not the enemy of the people. Thank you for listening. And Kim, who usually goes by Kim, is a science writer based primarily in Washington, D.C. Her work has appeared on websites including National Geographic, Slate, Science News, and many more. She's currently working on a project that will be located in Brazil as part of work done for a Pulitzer Center grant. Kim, thank you for taking the time to join me.
My pleasure.
So what's your journalism origin story?
So before I was a journalist, I was a scientist, and I had an epiphany sometime in the middle of my grad school program that my career as a scientist wasn't going to work out. I was studying this wonder material called molybdenum disulfide. It's a nanomaterial that's all the rage in the semiconductor industry. And that was my bread and butter. But then when a family member just asked me, what is MOS2 and why are you studying it? I kid you not, I could not answer that question. I knew that I was in serious trouble and something was really wrong with my ability to articulate information. So I decided to compensate for that by doing some science writing on the side to help with my communication skills. And I realized that even though I wasn't getting paid for this part-time internship that was occurring through my university, I was doing it once a week, every Tuesday for about 3 months. Tuesdays were my favorite days for that entire period of that internship. And I thought that signaled that science writing could be a viable career path for me. So after the end of my internship, I begged to stay on. They wouldn't let me, which I'm so thankful for that. I started freelancing on the side until I established a decent portfolio that allowed me to lay the groundwork to establish all those editor connections and do it full-time as I'm doing it now. So you can say that my journalism career really has been just one long overcorrection to my inability to answer the question, what is molybdenum disulfide?
Okay, and I want to go back a little further. I want to know about your background. As far as I know, you were born in Malaysia. You went to, for school, among other places, Caltech, which is the best of the best of the best. And I'm curious also if there's anything in your family or heritage that lends itself to storytelling.
Yeah, I'm a scientist by training, so I naturally gravitate towards science stories. I am from Malaysia, as you pointed out. So sometimes I really interrogate my experiences of like growing up in a country that with rich like tropical wildlife that the outside world would call exotic, but it's quite, not to say familiar to us, but rather it's quite well known to us and we don't see as exotic. So I try to interrogate my experiences and ask myself, is there a potential story that I could mine from this experience? I am aware of this wildlife. Could I find a scientist who studies that, for example? And my favorite kind of stories are those local stories that have lessons that can be extended to other countries. And that's how I use my background to find stories. I'd love to one day move back home for a few months and maybe go around the country, my home country, to search for stories, but that hasn't happened yet. Maybe one day it will.
Is there anyone in your family or heritage that has a journalism background in any way?
Not at all. I wouldn't say I encountered resistance to pursuing journalism, but my family was a little nervous for me when I started out, but I think I've convinced them that I can make it work financially.
So, and I do want to ask too, what was Caltech like?
It was hard. It's easy to be a very good science student in high school, but then bring a bunch of pretty smart kids from all around the world there, you quickly realize that maybe you're not the smartest around, except for a few people and some of my classmates, of course. I think Caltech was the first crack in my self-confidence that I could be a scientist. I definitely really like, still really like science, but I decided that maybe the academic career wouldn't necessarily be my eventual the job I would end up with. But I wanted to keep pursuing research to maybe go to industry where I could at least have a stable career and still be part of like cutting edge research. But that all those illusions were dashed in grad school, and now I'm still a part of that, but only as a journalist.
Okay, so explain, and you already have done this a little bit. Can you explain the path that you've gotten to this point where you're now doing this project that is in its very early stages for as part of a Pulitzer Center grant?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started science writing in graduate school, and I feel like my path is very similar to many scientists turned science writers that I really look up to. After freelancing for several years in grad school, as well as taking some internships on the side, I worked as a staff writer at Chemical and Engineering News magazine as a life sciences reporter for about 13 months. And then finally, last August, I left to do freelancing full time. I had freelancing experience then, and I was flexing the same muscles in terms of like pitching, finding story ideas from single studies, doing single study stories. And I really enjoyed that, but I wanted to challenge myself to step outside my comfort zone and do something I've never really done before, which is to pursue like bigger projects that really required me to travel and be a real fish out of water. So the Pulitzer grant project came out of a single study story that I did and I was really proud of, but I realized there was more depth to that. So I found once I saw the posting for this grant, I thought this one article that I did about the story, well, the story that I did that paved the way to a bigger project, this my story for Manga Bay, would be perfect for this grant. And I'm so thankful that the Pulitzer committee agreed.
This is a story that you did on pesticides and childhood cancer in Brazil. Can we kind of go into that from maybe how did the initial idea for that develop to what did it look like when you finished it?
The single study story itself, or the
Yeah,
entire.
the manga based story.
Yeah, it that manga based story really came out of me just staying on top of new research that came out. So I saw this study, this single study, this new research paper that mentioned that measured the impact of pesticides in Brazil and how they increased the incidence of childhood cancer in a particular region, and the geographical mapping of this cancer incidence with the potential that this spread of this environmental sort of like leaching or contamination, not really contamination yet, but like signs of this, the footprint of pesticides was really compelling. When I saw that study, I was really, I found the implications really profound. And I interviewed the researchers of the study as well as other expert sources. But the authors of the study, they weren't Brazilian. They were visiting researchers who were absolutely qualified to talk about the study themselves, but they didn't dare comment on the nuances of like what it's like living there. But thankfully, I interviewed an expert to comment on the study who was Brazilian, and he gave me so much more depth, and he mentioned all these other health problems that his own research was had uncovered, and this was one of them. This the cancer incidence was something that was that he his own research has had also found evidence of in other different studies. So I realized that there was this untold story, and I wanted to pursue it further, especially when it came to the impact of pesticides on mental health. So I've stayed connected with this Brazilian researcher, and I'm hoping to visit him in the fields, visit him in the university, and hopefully we can both go to the fields together sometime this year.
You would go and you would, the idea of the project is that you would go and speak to people that are living through this. This is kind of a follow-up, right?
Right, absolutely. I will admit that the project is still in its very early stages. I haven't finalized the travel dates or the logistics yet, but I think that's how all projects start. Like I when when I'm still here, I'm trying to contact scientists, experts, as much as I can, do these pre-interviews, make sure I establish some sort of trust before I just go in and try to report the story. I do want to try to avoid parachute journalism, meaning coming in and trying to report on a story that I don't know much of. So I definitely want to lay the foundation of building that background expertise, as well as establishing trust with sources as much as I can.
So this actually sounds similar to a few projects that we've had other people on talk about that are in the United States. In fact, we just had Bennett Goldstein on talking about this. So let me ask you about a few of the other pieces that you've written. I want to give people an indication of the variety of the kinds of science writing that you do. Scientific American is one place that you've written for. Your stories for them really run the gamut, everything from people creating simulations of alien messages to things where you're reviewing studies, such as most recently a study of coin flips and whether they're really 50-50. Spoiler alert, apparently they're not. But let's take one that's serious. You did a story on precision oncology and cancer drugs, not just the drugs, but the access to them. It's pretty much an explanatory piece. What was that one like to write, and how do you approach writing it for a Scientific American audience?
Right. That story is about precision oncology, which is a cutting-edge treatment for cancer, and it works by tailoring a treatment according to a cancer's genetic signature. Or in some ways that addresses the root cause of the cancer. So it's all the rage right now. It's the best tool we have, or the newest tool we have against cancer. So I started reporting on it because a new study came out that said since the first precision drug came out in 1998, nearly 50% of all new drugs since then, precision oncology drugs. So 50%, what does that mean? So basically, I approached writing this study by really trying to explain what does it mean by what this 50% means, especially to someone who is concerned about getting cancer treatment. I really tried to write this article from the perspective of the patient itself. What questions would they be most concerned about? Is 50% a lot or not enough? And of course, like with any drugs, there's actually a lot of access issues when it comes to these treatments. And I think the thing that people need to know about precision oncology drugs is that all these treatments are actually tailored to you, so to the patient, depending on the genetic signature, as I mentioned. So that means like sometimes people can't qualify. What happens to those people who actually don't qualify? Are their treatments being developed for them? Precision medicine seems very buzzwordy, and it's getting a lot of traction, and lots of investments are pouring to them, but are people exploring other cancers that have a different kind of genetic signature that maybe the minority have, and it might not be as lucrative upfront to develop a drug for a minority market, for example? So these are questions I really, really wanted to dig into. At the end of the day, like 50%, it's just a number. What does that mean, practically speaking, to cancer patients? What's the root what drove my research?
Taking the macro and making it a micro story. That's something that I'm particularly a fan of. On a slightly different note, I dug through the archives a little bit and found from December of 2021 for National Geographic, you're writing about the world's largest, stinkiest flower. It's a specific species that is one of the national flowers of Indonesia. And you have a great quote from a scientist who says that plants are easier to talk to than humans, which I thought was tremendous. What was that one like to write, and how did you get the idea for something like that story?
I'm so glad you found that story. That's probably been one of my favorite stories to write on, because I feel like it's a local story that spotlighted far from communities that normally people won't get to hear from. And it also reflects a bit of my own heritage. It came into play when finding and reporting the story. So this Rafflesia, the world's stinkiest flower, the Rafflesia, is something I grew up hearing about because I'm from Malaysia, a Southeast Asian country that's neighbors with Indonesia. And I think everyone in Malaysia and probably Indonesia knows about Rafflesia. So it wasn't weird It's rare, but it wasn't weird. And to be fair, I haven't seen one in the flesh yet, and that's something I want to check off of my bucket list. But it really started out with during the pandemic times. I was trying to find story ideas, and so I was like interrogating my own background knowledge and Malaysian experiences, and I was like, "Huh, this Rafflesia. I'm sure there's a story about Rafflesia somewhere. Or I hope there is." And so I just quickly searched the names of scientists working with Rafflesias or working in that space, and just reached out to them and being really upfront, saying, "I'd love to interview you. I don't really know anything about this field, but would you still be willing to talk to me?" I will say though, when if you just Google Rafflesia and Rafflesia research, most of the media coverage on this has been about Western efforts trying to understand the exotic biology of Rafflesia. And it was kind of a little annoying to me in the fact that it's a Southeast Asian plant, but rarely do Southeast Asian scientists get interviewed or spotlighted. And I definitely wanted to correct that. So I stumbled upon this lovely researcher, Sophie Musidawati, whom I eventually interviewed for an article. I just reached out to her and just admitted, "I don't know anything. Could you just tell me about what your research you do?" And she admitted, "I am the first person to have successfully cultivated the Rafflesia in an artificial setting, meaning outside of the boundaries of the rainforest." First, being a bit more like to qualify first, the field admits that she's first, and she was the first one who had an established protocol and was willing to share it with the world, and it was reproducible. Some people have made claims about being the first, but they haven't had evidence to show for it. But she was the first one. So I was just so lucky that I stumbled upon this amazing character who was doing great work on a really very bizarre and very cool plant, the Rafflesia itself. And I was asking her about the process and what's it like. She admitted that sometimes she likes working alone. So I naturally just asked her, like, do you feel lonely? And then she just very openly admitted, like, sometimes she talks to them. She names her flowers too, which is a wonderful tidbit to include in my article.
You seem like a very thoughtful person with regards to this, because you've said on a couple of occasions, you've pointed out that they're not that you in reading the Western articles, you noticed that they weren't interviewing a certain type of person. You talked about for the cancer story that you wanted to write the story from the cancer patient, and I'm curious about what the thought process for you is like when you're just doing a story. Like, I guess, what's it like to think like you, if that's all right to ask?
Yeah, what's it like to think like me? I like stories that speak to just the average person on the street. I think I dissociate myself with like my scientific training in grad school and maybe my Caltech degree to that extent. I really just go down to the basics, or that I like to think I go down to the basics or the essence of a story, just to find something that would resonate with each and every one of us. I like to put myself in people's shoes and just ask myself, gee, if I had to do that, it must be lonely working in that botanical garden. I don't understand what 50% of new drugs, new or precision oncology drugs mean. What would that be like as a cancer patient? I also admit that doing that cancer story, my mom had cancer, so I understand the stress that going through that cancer treatment actually involves, and how harsh it is. So I just try to put myself in people's shoes and know my intended audience and try to think about what they would be curious about and try to answer those questions. I like to think maybe my brand of journalism is like writing about the underdogs for the underdogs. Not to say that there are hierarchical levels in society, but I do like to write about people whom are like underrepresented, or just average Joes, average Janes on the street, basically. Because I kind of feel like I'm one of them too.
One of the things, people who, as the people that I know that have had journalism training, when they get a quote like the one that you got about how plants are easier to talk to than humans, I know that for me, There's like a little dance. I'm like, I can see myself dancing in my head in celebration when the
Oh.
person says that. I'm curious, do you get that, or do you just like keep writing and you're like, oh yeah, and maybe put an asterisk and you're like, yeah, I'll get back to that.
No, not at all. I'm so happy when I get those kinds of quotes. And I think I don't always get those kind of quotes, but sometimes it depends on how lucky you are with your sources or how strong of a rapport you establish with them and how much they trust you, whether you've done a good job convincing them that you want to represent their story accurately and well, and convincing them that they're not crazy. Because, okay, I do that too. I speak to my plants, and it's usually, please grow, because I'm not a great, I don't have a green thumb.
What are the stories that you've done besides that one? Maybe pick one other one that you're most proud of.
Yeah. One story that I'm really proud of is my Scientific American article about the crazy, weird, strange world of artificial life research. Artificial life is a theoretical study, sort of theoretical study, where researchers are trying to create artificial life from scratch in the hopes of finding out what life is, what makes living things different from, say, a rock, a robot, or perhaps artificial intelligence. So I'm really proud of that story because it was so complex to report on. The research was full of jargon, so many a million different ideas. You talk to 20 people, 20 different people, you get 20 different ideas and more about what the field is. But I'm really proud of the article because I managed to create a good storyline about like what that field is, why it's weird, all the criticisms that make it not a respectable field, and why it still has redeeming qualities. So I'm really proud of finding that arc in that entire tangle of research. And the second reason I'm really proud of our story is because I think I gotten the best quote I've ever gotten in my life that even beats the quote about talking to plants. I kid you not. So I was talking to this researcher who was so tired of defending his field of research. If you're like me, or and I know that lots of people out there, especially outsiders of the artificial life field, like, what's the point of artificial life? I'm sure you probably thought about it when I mentioned that field of research. What's the point of creating artificial life? Will it advance drugs and or technology? Maybe, but the reason why people are motivated is because they want to find a definition of life, which doesn't sound very practical or pliable to any fields. So when I was speaking to this researcher, he was so tired of answering, what is the merit of artificial life? And he admitted, I'm not the first one to have said it, so he gave me this quote. Do you ever think, what is the merit of your grandmother? What is the merit of your dog? Which I thought was ridiculous, and I love that quote. I had to fight to have to keep that quote in my article, but I'm so glad I did. And it just shows his frustration and almost the ridiculousness of this question, because other basic science research fields don't get that, like theoretical physics or math. Sometimes they don't get that as much as they don't get those kinds of questions as much as artificial life yet. Or maybe they did when they first started.
Let me move on to some more general topics. And all of the articles that you've cited, I will include them in the show notes for those that are listening. What are the journalism issues that you're most passionate about?
I'm really concerned about how to fund journalism and make sure it's alive. Like, journalism isn't cheap. Investigative journalism isn't cheap. I'm not sure if people have heard about, especially those outside the journalism industry, but there have been so many layoffs, so many like media outlet collapses that sometimes I wonder what's going to happen to all of us. Are there enough jobs for all of us? So I'm really concerned about the funding, but at the same time, we can't necessarily like take a lot of donations because journalism can't be beholden to any big organization funder, especially venture capitalists, because we need to hold organizations accountable. So I think lots of people in the industry have settled on a subscriber-based model as the best kind of best most ethical kind of funding model. But of course, there are limitations to that. So that's something that's really on my mind. And I think One thing that's really rising right now is the like worker-owned cooperative-based kind of model. And I really want to mention this on the show, but a few friends and I are also jumping on that bandwagon. We're about to start a new science journalism outlet to be released in the next few weeks, hopefully. Our new outlet name is called Sequencer, and please stay tuned and please come visit our site when we launch sometime in about a week or two.
Wow, that's fantastic. You're welcome to give more
Thanks.
details about it if you like.
Yeah, Quincy is our grand experiment to write about things that me and three other journalists care about on a personal level and have our voice be what's unique and drives people to our site, hopefully. We're all quite experienced science journalists that we have our own passions, we have our own way of seeing the world, and we really care about journalism success and the way it's portrayed and the way science is portrayed. And we want to do it accurately without being beholden to anyone. So I just hope everyone comes and checks it out. We're trying to be unique in just the way all four of us as successful freelancers bring our own unique perspective to the world and do it rigorous through accurate reporting. One of my colleagues, Max, he mentioned that maybe we should call stuff like rigorous shit posters, if I can say that.
What's the hardest part about being a journalist?
For me, it's really battling imposter syndrome every day. There are like financial struggles in the industry, really talented people are getting laid off. As a freelancer, kind of nerve-wracking to navigate this space and hope that the industry doesn't collapse. And now we have threats of like AI potentially taking over our jobs. We don't think it will, but maybe the people holding the purses might think AI is better than us journalists. And so the constant threat of like this existential threat versus my own sometimes negative self-talk sometimes makes journalism a bit hard to do on day to day. I'm sure, like I always say that, I know, I'm sure there's some really confident journalists out there, but if you could find me a journalist with no imposter syndrome, it's like finding a unicorn, I think. So I know that I'm not alone in this, and I just try to like focus on the work and just get it done, do a great job, and do justice to the stories that my sources tell me.
I find that particularly fascinating given your educational background.
Oh, really? Not at all. I think at most has made me feel like people expect more things of me, and sometimes I really don't feel any different from anyone else, or maybe not as good as anyone else. Really, imposter syndrome, sometimes I feel like it's paralyzing.
We should point out you're a doctor. You have a doctorate in molecular engineering.
I don't always report on my field of research.
Right.
And I think maybe that has given me an advantage because I think I don't usually fall into the jargon trap, though maybe my editors might argue with me about that. But I think just not having a PhD allows me to, or like being willing to admit that I'm a noob at something allows me to connect with sources on a very human-to-human level.
Sure, I think it makes asking the questions easier sometimes. I do want to ask, we've been asking everyone this among our guests recently, how do you manage your mental health? And I'm going to request with this that you tell us about, even if it doesn't necessarily apply here, tell us about your fencing background.
To be honest, I haven't done fencing in a long time. I love it. Fencing is, if you've ever played a game where, as a kid, where you try to slap someone and not be slapped, fencing is just like that, except you want to try and look cooler doing it. Fencing is really expensive. It's one of those fancy ass equipment, lots of equipment kind of sports that I really could never have done on my own, even in Malaysia. I was from a small town that didn't have that kind of facilities. I only stumbled upon it at Caltech. Caltech is not known for its sports, which is a great thing because they welcome all levels, especially beginner levels, to join the sports team. And if you say, "Oh, I'm too busy to come to training. I need to do my homework sets," You're off the hook of training, and so that's why we're never really good. But that's great. It allowed me to like just join and just have fun, and Caltech was nice that they paid for all my equipment too. So I haven't done fencing yet because now I have to. Since I've left Caltech, because I now have to get all my equipment, but I really miss it. And one day, if I really succeed at this freelancing thing and a lot of money, maybe I'll go back to it. But
Okay,
now,
so that's how you hand. I would imagine that fencing was a good way to release some stress back then. What do you do to manage your mental health now?
yeah, I do want to point out one thing. I realized that when you're mad and stressed, you become a worse fencer because you can't think rationally and somehow you can't react appropriately to your opponent. You have to be in a really calm state of mind to be able to like anticipate attacks or read their body language. But when you're mad, fencing is probably one of the worst things you could do because you only get more frustrated with every loss. So I wanted to just point that out.
Okay.
But now I do admit sometimes I'm a workaholic. I'm not the fastest writer, so sometimes assignments take me a lot of time. That sometimes I really feel like I don't have a lot of spare time. But one thing I really started picking up in the last week, I think, is chess. I used to play a little bit of chess in middle school. It was just a phase. But now I'm finally revisiting it, and I realized that I'm much worse at it now, but it flexes a part of the analytical part of my brain that had gone rusty since I left like my scientific education and training. So it's really nice to be able to move that part of the brain again to some extent. And right now I'm still a beginner, so I'm playing against the computer at the most beginner level settings and realizing I don't suck too much. And so like really slaying the beginner level computer has given me a really nice dopamine boost.
I imagine, imposter syndrome there too, but at the beginner level, once you start to dominate, there you go. That hopefully takes care of it. All right. So one other before we get to the last question, which is how has being a journalist and becoming one in your case, because of the transition, shaped how you view the world?
Yeah, I think being a journalist has helped me realize like the power of stories to move people. There is so much misinformation out there, and it's exhausting as a journalist to keep like chasing after that and debunking it. And being a journalist has shown me like how much like being factually accurate or sh shouting facts or debunking facts isn't the probably the most convincing way or the best way to win an argument. If you want to like shout facts and to win an argument, at most you can do that with journalists. But yeah, I think just like it has frightened me, this the power of misinformation to like sway the public and manipulate them. That's a challenge that we had to do, and I would never have realized the extent of it had I not been in working in this space.
And we're grateful that you are. She and Kim, who goes by Kim, the show is called The Journalism Salute. We salute you for your good work and we ask that you do likewise. Is there a journalist or journalism organization that you would like to salute for their good work?
Yeah, there's so many. I really want to credit the Open Notebook, this website about all things about the craft of science journalism, led by the wonderful Siri Carpenter. I want to salute two journalists that I spoke to for career advice this year. One of them is Jane C. Hu, who's also a scientist turned science writer, and whose career path I really want to emulate. The second person I want to salute to is Brent Crane, who actually was perhaps one of the reasons why I applied for the Pulitzer grant to do my Brazil story. I was hoping to shake up my career a bit, and I wasn't sure I could do it. But speaking with Brent, he advised me to have a bit more inflated confidence to pursue stories that you don't think you can do. I'm not saying that I can't do the story. I hope editors don't have that takeaway from this chat, but as journalists, we have to keep growing, and I didn't go through a traditional journalism degree, like educate. I didn't go through a journalism education, so everything has been very DIY. So the only way to learn and grow is to just like do it and As a journalist, I think we often have this misconception that we're working alone, but we have an editor who's helping us. So don't be afraid to pursue stories if you see a good one. And thank you, Brent, for giving me that career advice.
Kim, thank you for taking the time to join us on this episode. We will certainly be following your work. We will follow your new website, and we look forward to seeing what you do in your future.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Journalism Salute. Please let us know what you think of the show. You can find us on Twitter at JournalismPod, and you can email us at journalismsalute@gmail.com.